Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Testimony this morning before the Senate Armed Services Committee on the State of the War in Iraq by General David Petraeus, top U.S. commander in Iraq, and Ryan Crocker, U.S. ambassador to Iraq. This hour, On Point will listen in with top analysts on the statements and questioning of General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker. With us to do that, two keen observers of America's effort in Iraq, Ambassador James Dobbins, who served as U.S. Special Envoy for Afghanistan, Somalia, Haiti, Bosnia, and Kosovo. Ambassador Dobbins, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
And General William Odom, retired Army Lieutenant General and former Director of the National Security Agency. General Odom, thank you for being here.
Yes, glad to be with you.
Opening statements made this morning. Let's just get a flavor of those before we join the testimony from General Petraeus. Here's Committee Chairman Democrat Carl Levin of Michigan opening the hearing, saying that recent violence in Iraq calls into question the Bush administration's surge strategy.
This new increase in violence raises questions about the military success of the surge. But more significantly, the purpose of the surge, as announced by President Bush last year, which was to give the Iraqi leaders breathing room to work out a settlement, has not been achieved. That reality leads many of us to once again challenge President Bush's policies.
And in the opening statements of ranking Republican member of the committee, Senator John McCain, talk of success.
Well, while the job of bringing security to Iraq is not finished, as the recent fighting in Basra and elsewhere vividly demonstrated, we're no longer staring into the abyss of defeat, and we can now look ahead to the genuine prospect of success.
Ambassador Dobbins, General Odom, let's join the testimony now from General David Petraeus to the Senate Armed Services Committee.
In the coming months, Iraq leaders must strengthen governmental capacity, execute budgets, pass additional legislation, conduct provincial elections, carry out a census, determine the status of disputed territories, and resettle internally displaced persons and refugees. These tasks would challenge any government, much less a still-developing government tested by war. The Commander's Emergency Response Program, the State Department's Quick Response Fund, and the USAID programs enable us to help Iraq deal with its challenges. To that end, I respectfully ask that you provide us by June the additional SERP funds requested in the supplemental. These funds have an enormous impact. As I noted earlier, the salaries paid to the Sons of Iraq alone cost far less than the cost savings and vehicles not lost due to the enhanced security in local communities. Encouragingly, the Iraqi government recently allocated $300 million for us to manage as Iraqi SERP to perform projects for their people while building their own capacity to do so. The Iraqi government has also committed $163 million to gradually assume Sons of Iraq contracts, $510 million for small business loans, and $196 million for a joint training, education, and reintegration program. The Iraqi government pledges to provide more as they execute the budget passed 2 months ago. Nonetheless, it is hugely important to have our resources continue even as Iraqi funding begins to outstrip ours. Last month, I provided my chain of command recommendations for the way ahead in Iraq. During that process, I noted the objective of retaining and building on our hard-fought security gains while we draw down to the pre-surge level of 15 brigade combat teams. I emphasized the need to continue work with our Iraqi partners to secure the population and to transition responsibilities to the Iraqis as quickly as conditions permit, but without jeopardizing the security gains that have been made. As in September, my recommendations are informed by operational and strategic considerations. The operational considerations include recognition that the military surge has achieved progress, but that that progress is reversible. Iraqi security forces have strengthened their capabilities, but still must grow further. The provincial elections in the fall, refugee returns, detainee releases, and efforts to resolve provincial boundary disputes and Article 140 issues will be very challenging. The transition of Sons of Iraq into the Iraqi security forces or other pursuits will require time and careful monitoring. Withdrawing too many forces too quickly could jeopardize the progress of the past year, and performing the necessary tasks in Iraq will require sizable conventional forces as well as special operations forces and advisor teams. The strategic considerations include recognition that the strain on the U.S. military, especially on its ground forces, has been considerable. A number of the security challenges inside Iraq are also related to significant regional and global threats. A failed state in Iraq would pose serious consequences for the greater fight against al-Qaeda, for regional stability, for the already existing humanitarian crisis in Iraq, and for the efforts to counter malign Iranian influence. After weighing these factors, I recommended to my chain of command that we continue the drawdown of the surge combat forces, and that upon the withdrawal of the last surge brigade combat team in July, we undertake a 45-day period of consolidation and evaluation. At the end of that period, we will commence a process of assessment to examine the conditions on the ground and, over time, determine when we can make recommendations for further reductions. This process will be continuous, with recommendations for further reductions made as conditions permit. This approach does not allow establishment of a set withdrawal timetable. However, it does provide the flexibility those of us on the ground need to preserve the still fragile security gains our troopers have fought so hard and sacrificed so much to achieve. With this approach, the security achievements of 2007 and early 2008 can form a foundation for the gradual establishment of sustainable security in Iraq. This is not only important to the 27 million citizens of Iraq, it is also vitally important to those in the Gulf region, to the citizens of the United States, and to the global community. It clearly is in our national interest to help Iraq prevent the resurgence of al-Qaeda in the heart of the Arab world, to help Iraq resist Iranian encroachment on its sovereignty, to avoid renewed ethno-sectarian violence that could spill over Iraq's borders and make the existing refugee crisis even worse, and to enable Iraq to expand its role in the regional and global economies. In closing, I want to comment briefly on those serving our nation in Iraq. We have asked a great deal of them and of their families, and they have made enormous sacrifices. My keen personal awareness of the strain on them and on the force as a whole has been an important factor in my recommendations. The Congress, the executive branch, and our fellow citizens have done an enormous amount to support our troopers and their loved ones, and all of us are grateful for that. Nothing means more to those in harm's way than the knowledge that their country appreciates their sacrifices and those of their families. Indeed, all Americans should take great pride in the men and women serving our nation in Iraq and in the courage, determination, resilience, and initiative they demonstrate each and every day. It remains the greatest of honors to soldier with them. Thank you very much.
Thank you, General Petraeus. Ambassador Crocker.
U.S. Ambassador Ryan Crocker.
Mr. Chairman, Senator McCain, members of the committee, it is an honor to appear before you today to provide my assessment on political, economic, and diplomatic developments in Iraq. When General Petraeus and I reported to you in September, I gave my considered judgment on whether our goals in Iraq were attainable. Can Iraq develop into a united, stable country with a democratically elected government operating under the rule of law? Last September, I said that the cumulative trajectory of political, economic, and diplomatic developments in Iraq was upwards, although the slope of that line was not steep. Developments over the last 7 months have strengthened my sense of a positive trend. Immense challenges remain, and progress is uneven and often frustratingly slow.
Ambassador Ryan Crocker, U.S. Ambassador to Iraq, there beginning his briefing of the Senate Armed Services Committee this morning on Capitol Hill. Ambassador James Dobbin joins us and General William Odom. James Dobbin, if I may first come to you on what we heard in the opening statement this morning from General Petraeus. Is this a positive report from the top U.S. commander in Iraq? Is this a report that justifies, what does he say, drawing down but then pausing and waiting to see if more troops can come out?
I think it's a moderately positive report and a carefully calculated effort to balance domestic American pressures for withdrawals against a still very delicate security situation in Iraq.
William Odom, General Odom, you're listening closely as a former military man. What do you hear in the opening testimony of David Petraeus today?
Well, I agree with what James Dobbins just said. I think he has really sliced it finely here. He isn't asking for the surge to stay at the level that it is indefinitely, as he was reported to earlier, but let it go down and then take a pause review. So that gives him until fall to have another look at things. It strikes me that the underlying assumption in his discussion of the military situation is that a political consolidation is really feasible. And I think that's the question that both Crocker and Petraeus are dodging and handling only with assumptions. Similar in its complexity
to our own assumptions, because you're saying not enough evidence of that political progress on the ground.
Exactly. You heard the ambassador say that he asked the right question. Can a liberal, stable democracy be created in Iraq? He says now he thinks the trends are positive, but doesn't say how positive, and he thinks things are still fragile, and so does General Petraeus. So that leaves them in a very kind of ambiguous position. They certainly say they give you noises that are positive, but their confidence in reaching these goals is not very strongly expressed.
James Dobbins, many qualifications from General Petraeus this morning, many reminders of the fragility and the reversibility of the progress that's been made.
Right. I mean, there's no doubt that a combination of more sophisticated tactics, more troops, and some fortuitous circumstances in Iraq led to increased security over the last year. And this is obviously good news. But it's a very fragile equilibrium that we've established. We've established it essentially by ourselves helping to arm and equip all three of the main factions that have been engaged from one time to another in a civil war. And the equilibrium and the more or less peace between these factions depends on us continuing to support all three of them.
When we come back, more testimony from before the Senate Armed Services Committee. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Listening in this hour on testimony this morning before the Senate Armed Services Committee by General David Petraeus, Commander of U.S. Forces in Iraq, and Ambassador Ryan Crocker, U.S. Ambassador to Iraq, who's testifying behind me now. We're joined by Ambassador James Dobbins and General William Odom listening in with us, and we will have elements of their analysis here as well. We may get to a call at 800-423-TALK. Senator Carl Levin opened the proceedings this morning on Capitol Hill. Senator John McCain, the ranking minority member, also with opening statements. We will hear questions from them soon. Let's listen in to Ryan Crocker talking about the current political situation in Iraq.
And there is still very much to be done to bring full government control to the streets of Basra and eliminate entrenched extremist, criminal, and militia groups. But when viewed with a broader lens, the Iraqi decision to take on these groups in Basra has major significance. First, a Shia majority government led by Prime Minister Maliki has demonstrated its commitment to taking on criminals and extremists regardless of identity. Second, Iraqi security forces led these operations in Basra and in towns and cities throughout the south. British and U.S. elements played important roles, but these were supporting roles as they should be. The operation in Basra has also shaken up Iraqi politics. The Prime Minister returned to Baghdad from Basra shortly before General Petraeus and I left for Washington, and he is confident in his decision and determined to press the fight against illegal groups. But he is also determined to take a hard look at lessons learned. The efforts of the government against extremist militia elements have broad political support, as a statement April 5 by virtually all of Iraq's main political leaders, Sunni, Shia, and Kurd, made clear in support of Prime Minister Maliki's government. A wild card remains the Sadrist trend and whether the Iraqis can continue to drive a wedge between other elements of the trend and Iranian-supported special groups. A dangerous development in the immediate wake of the Basra operation was what appeared to be a reunification between special groups and mainline Jaish al-Mahdi. We also saw a potential collapse of the Jaish al-Mahdi freeze in military operations. As the situation unfolded, however, Muqtada Sadr issued a statement that disavowed anyone possessing heavy weapons, which would include the signature weapons of the special groups. This statement can further sharpen the distinction between members of the Sadrist trend, who who should not pose a threat to the Iraqi state, and members of the special groups who very much do. One conclusion I draw from these signs of progress is that the strategy that began with the surge is working. This does not mean that U.S. support should be open-ended or that the level and nature of our engagement should not diminish over time. It is in this context that we have begun negotiating a bilateral relationship between Iraq and the United States. In August, Iraq's five principal leaders requested a long-term relationship with the United States to include economic, political, diplomatic, and security cooperation. The heart of this relationship will be a legal framework for the presence of American troops similar to that which exists in nearly 80 countries around the world. The Iraqis view the negotiation of this framework as a strong affirmation of Iraqi sovereignty, placing Iraq on par with other U.S. allies and removing the stigma of Chapter 7 status under the U.N. Charter, pursuant to which coalition forces presently operate. Such an agreement is in Iraq's interest and ours. U.S. forces will remain in Iraq beyond December 31, 2008, when the U.N. resolution presently governing their presence expires. Our troops will need basic authorizations and protections to continue operations, and this agreement will provide those authorizations and protections. The agreement will not establish permanent bases in Iraq, and we anticipate that it will expressly forswear them. The agreement will not specify troop levels, and it will not tie the hands of the next administration. Our aim is to ensure that the next president arrives in office with a stable foundation upon which to base policy decisions. And that is precisely what this agreement will do. Congress will remain fully informed as these negotiations proceed in the coming weeks and months. Mr. Chairman, significant challenges remain in Iraq. A reinvigorated cabinet is necessary both for political balance and to improve the delivery of services to Iraq's people. Challenges to the rule of law, especially corruption, are enormous. Disputed internal boundaries, the Article 140 process, must be resolved. The return of refugees and the internally displaced must be managed. The rights of women and minorities must be better protected. Iraqis are aware of the challenges they face and are working on them. Iraq's political progress will not be linear. Developments which are on the whole positive can still have unanticipated or destabilizing consequences. The decision to hold provincial elections, vital for Iraq's democratic development and long-term stability, will also produce new strains. Some of the violence we have seen recently in southern Iraq reflects changing dynamics within the Shia community as the political and security context changes. Such inflection points underscore the fragility of the situation in Iraq, but it would be wrong to conclude that any eruption of violence marks the beginning of an inevitable backslide. In terms of economics and capacity building, in September, I reported to you that there had been some gains in Iraq's economy and in the country's efforts to build capacity to translate these gains into more effective governance and services. Iraqis have built on these gains over the past month, as is most evident in the revival of marketplaces across Iraq and the reopening of long-shuttered businesses. According to a Center for International Private Enterprise poll last month, 78% of Iraqi business owners surveyed expect the Iraqi economy to grow significantly in the next 2 years. With improving security and rising government expenditures, the IMF projects that Iraq's GDP will grow 7% in real terms this year, and inflation has been tamed.
U.S. Ambassador Ryan Crocker getting into economic projections in Iraq. A couple of big statements and assertions here. General William Odom and Ambassador James Dobbins are listening with us. General Odom, if I may come to you for just a moment here. The ambassador has stated in the last couple of minutes, the strategy that began with the surge is working. How do you respond to that depiction of the situation in Iraq, General Odom?
I think it couldn't be more wrong. The way they're stating it sounds very nice, but it's terribly misleading. I should have made a point earlier that I don't think the violence is down because of the surge. The violence is down because both sides have decided to rearm and get ready for bigger fights. And to describe the put-down of the Mahdi people in Basra as just opposing extremist groups is to overlook that the ruling party is pretty extreme in the way it behaves. So we really don't have any moderate groups to deal with. The disturbing thing I hear about this is the assumption that progress actually can be made. I don't see any political progress whatsoever, and what's passed off as military stability strikes me as just realignments for greater military instability. And to talk about to put Iraq and our relationship in Iraq in the category with other U.S. Allies is to really mix apples and oranges. This is seems to me a gross misclassification. But I don't think they have any choice but to try to put the best spin on this, and you can see the difficulties they're facing with the UN mandate runs out. The legitimacy of our presence would go away if they don't work out something with the government.
General or Ambassador Dobbins, Ambassador Crocker saying here that work on an agreement is well underway between the U.S. and Iraqi governments, expressly forswearing, he said, permanent U.S. bases in Iraq, and giving the next president a stable foundation on which to base future decisions. Let me ask you first about that latter part. Do you see the next president and two potentials in that number are sitting in the room right now with the ambassador, that is John McCain and Hillary Clinton. Do you see them lined up to receive a stable foundation for future decisions here?
I don't think the next president is going to receive a stable Iraq by any means, and I think that this agreement that's being negotiated, while it's depending on its contents desirable, it's going to be difficult to complete. And I would, if I had to bet, I would guess that we in the Iraqi government will not be able to resolve all of the issues that would be necessary. And as a result, we will go back to the UN and extend the UN mandate, which is what provides our forces there with the legal immunity and an ability to function, rather as an alternative to this agreement, which, while desirable, may not be reached.
You're predicting that it won't be possible for Washington and Baghdad to work out an agreement on a continued U.S. troop presence, even though the Baghdad government has called for exactly that?
They would definitely like to move out from under the U.N. Resolution and to have an agreement which gave them greater control and oversight over the activity of U.S. forces and, for instance, U.S. Civilian security elements that are responsible for some of the accidental deaths that have occurred in Iraq. My guess is that the negotiations over the degree to which Iraq would actually be able to exercise that oversight will be so difficult that that they may not be able to reach closure by the end of the year. It's not impossible that they'll have the agreement. Both sides do want it, but there are a lot of difficult issues to be reached. And I don't think it's the end of the world if they simply extend the existing UN mandate.
And General Odom, quickly, to this notion that the U.S. is pushing for an agreement that will expressly forswear permanent bases, does that mean that Americans can anticipate that there will not be permanent U.S. bases in Iraq?
No, I don't think this proves there won't be. It just puts it off. You can always change your mind and change the agreements 6 months or a year down the road. I think they're trying to preempt a lot of criticism. Accusations have been made that this is happening. Even if it is, I wouldn't be surprised if this is not covered, a kind of muddy the concerns about it and put it off to a later time.
Listening here to Ambassador Ryan Crocker with his continuing debrief of the Senate Armed Services Committee in the hall, Senator John McCain, the ranking Republican member of the committee, and Senator Hillary Clinton taking notes, preparing for her questioning, which will come later in the process. Ambassador James Dobbins joins us, and General William Odom, former director of the National Security Agency. Let's listen back in as we prepare for Ryan Crocker to wrap up his opening remarks, and we prepare for questions from, probably first from Carl Levin, the chairman, and perhaps John McCain. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Here's Ambassador Crocker.
It is noteworthy that the meeting was held in the Kurdish city of Erbil under the recently redesigned Iraqi flag, highlighting both the remarkable prosperity and stability of Iraq's Kurdish region and the presence of the Iraqi federal state. We hope that this event will encourage more active Arab engagements with Iraq, and we expect that Prime Minister Maliki's effort against Shia extremist militias in Basra will receive Arab support. The presence of the PKK terrorist organization in the remote mountains of Iraq along the Turkish border have produced tension between Turkey and Iraq and led to a Turkish cross-border operation in February, including movement of Turkish ground forces into Iraq. At the same time, both governments are working to strengthen their ties, and Iraqi President Talabani made a successful visit to Turkey in March. Syria plays an ambivalent role. We have seen evidence of efforts to interdict some foreign fighters seeking to transit Syria to Iraq, but others continue to cross the border. Syria also harbors individuals who finance and support the Iraqi insurgency. Iran continues to undermine the efforts of the Iraqi government to establish a stable, secure state through the authority, through the training of criminal militia elements engaged in violence against Iraqi security forces, coalition forces, and Iraqi civilians. The extent of Iran's malign influence was dramatically demonstrated when militia elements, armed and trained by Iran, clashed with Iraqi government forces in Basra and Baghdad. When the president announced the surge, he pledged to seek and destroy Iranian-supported lethal networks inside Iraq. We know more about those networks and their Quds Force sponsors than ever before, and we will continue to aggressively uproot and destroy them. At the same time, we support constructive relations between Iran and Iraq and are participating in a tripartite process to discuss the security situation in Iraq. Iran has a choice to make. Looking ahead, Mr. Chairman, almost everything about Iraq is hard. It will continue to be hard as Iraqis struggle with the damage and trauma inflicted by 35 years of totalitarian Ba'athist rule. But hard does not mean hopeless, and the political and economic progress of the past few months is significant. These gains are fragile, however, and they are reversible. Americans have invested a great deal in Iraq, in blood as well as treasure, and they have the right to ask whether this is worth it, whether it is now time to walk away and let the Iraqis fend for themselves. Iraq has the potential to develop into a stable, secure, multi-ethnic, multi-sectarian democracy under the rule of law. Whether it realizes that potential is ultimately up to the Iraqi people. Our support, however, will continue to be critical. I said in September that I cannot guarantee success in Iraq. That is still the case, although I think we are closer. I remain convinced that a major departure from our current engagement would bring failure, and we have to be clear with ourselves about what failure would mean. Al-Qaeda is in retreat in Iraq, but it is not yet defeated. Al-Qaeda's leaders are looking for every opportunity they can to hang on. Osama bin Laden has called Iraq the perfect base, and it reminds us that a fundamental aim of Al-Qaeda is to establish itself in the Arab world. It almost succeeded in Iraq. We cannot allow it a second chance. And it is not only Al-Qaeda that would benefit. Iran has said publicly it will fill any vacuum in Iraq, and extremist Shia militias would reassert themselves. We saw them try in Basra and Baghdad 2 weeks ago. And in all of this, the Iraqi people would suffer on a scale far beyond what we have already seen. Spiraling conflict could draw in neighbors with devastating consequences for the region and the world.
Ambassador Ryan Crocker wrapping up his opening statement before the Senate Armed Services Committee in testimony with General David Petraeus as well today in Washington. We'll come back and hear more as the questioning begins. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're listening in on testimony this morning before the Senate Armed Services Committee by General David Petraeus, Commander U.S. Forces in Iraq, and Ambassador Ryan Crocker, U.S. Ambassador there. With us, Ambassador James Dobbins and General William Odom, listening along. We're grateful for their perspective. Questioning has begun. Carl Levin, Democrat of Michigan, has opened with his first question to
of assessment.
General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker. Let's listen.
Assessment is, but then there's some open-ended process of assessment, and over time there'll be another determination. Now, it seems to me that what you've given to your chain of command is a plan which has no end to it. You do not use the word which Secretary Gates used twice, which is that it would be a brief pause. I assume that's intentional. Do you agree with Secretary Gates it will be a brief pause or not? Do you use the term brief?
What Secretary Gates has described, as I understand it, is a brief period of consolidation and evaluation.
No, he used the term brief pause, General.
Well,
at any rate, without okay. going into that,
General David Petraeus with
February,
Senator Levin
the
here.
Term brief pause. But you're not using the term brief. Is that correct?
Sir, I'm not using the word brief nor the word pause. What I stated was a 45-day period for consolidation and evaluation. That's to examine the situation on the ground, do the battlefield geometry, consult with Ambassador Crocker on what might be called the political-military calculus, and then conduct the assessments. And when the assessment is at a point that the conditions are met to
General Petraeus talking here about
reduction of forces, then
draw down until July and then a 45-day assessment period. Carl Levin zeroing in on exactly
after
that.
After which we do the assessments, and as the conditions are met for further reductions, then we make those recommendations.
Now, if do you have any estimate at all as to how long that second period is going to take? Are you giving us any ideas to how long that will take? You say over time.
Sir,
month? Could that be 2 months?
Sir, it could be less than that.
Could it be more than that?
It could be more than that. Again, right. It's when the conditions are met that we can make a recommendation for further reductions.
Could it be 3 months?
Sir, again, at the end of the period of consolidation and evaluation, it could be right then, or it could be longer. Again, it is when...
Could you...
We've got a heckler in the Senate hall.
We're asking the audience. If you could bring the gentleman out, I'm afraid we're going to have to ask him to leave. General. General, we're going to ask you this question again. Could it be as long as 3 months?
Sir, it could be. That's all I'm asking. It is when the conditions
police escorting
are
met.
I understand, but I'm just asking a direct question. Could that be as long as 3 months?
It could be, sir.
Could it be as long as 4 months?
Sir, it is when the conditions are met. Again.
Now, next question. If all goes well, what would be the approximate number of our troops there at the end of the year? Let's assume conditions permitted things to move quickly. What, in your estimate, would be the approximate number of American troops there at the end of the year? Can you give us an estimate?
I can't give you an estimate.
You're not going to give us an estimate on that. Next question. General, an April 3rd article in the New York Times said that before the Iraqi government's assault on the Mahdi army in Basra, you counseled Prime Minister Maliki, quote, "We made a lot of gains in the past 6 to 9 months that you'll be putting at risk." The article also states that you advised him not to rush into a fight without carefully sizing up the situation and making adequate preparations. Now, did he follow your advice?
Sir, he laid out a plan that would, in fact, incorporate that advice.
All right. And, did he follow your advice then?
And once the forces got into Basra, they ended up going into action more quickly than was anticipated.
Would you say that Maliki followed your advice?
I would not. No, sir.
In your judgment, was the Iraqi government operation in Basra properly and carefully planned, and were the preparations adequate? In your professional judgment, was the Iraqi government operation in Basra properly and carefully planned, and were the preparations adequate?
Sir, there's no question but that it could have been better planned and that the preparations could have been better. And we've already done initial after-action reviews on that, in fact, there and also in Baghdad.
Reference here to the Iraq central government's push into Basra to clean up militias, which ended in a ceasefire called by Muqtada al-Sadr, an apparent failure for Prime Minister Maliki.
Could you give me a direct answer? In your judgment, was the Iraqi government operation in Basra properly and carefully planned, and were the preparations adequate? Could you give me a direct answer?
Sir, the answer is, again, it could have been much better planned. It was not adequately planned or prepared. I mean, again, it was laid out to us. The objectives were described. And, in fact, the process as it was laid out was logical. But I've not seen too many combat operations that have gone as they were planned, and this was
General Odom. How do you see the contention behind this exchange? What's at stake here?
Senator Levin's getting right to the core of the issue. He's beginning to pull the veneer off Petraeus's comfortable half truth. The situation is not militarily stable at all, and what Maliki did was to show us that the quiet and apparent peace on the Shiite side was merely a waiting period till they could really have a fight about it. And this is probably just the opening fight in a long series of a struggle in the Shiite community.
Ambassador Dobbins, this recent period of fighting and its end has been described here as Maliki stepping up in some sense, but on balance, do you see it as reflecting well on the effort of the surge?
Senator McCain.
I think that the administration and both Crocker and Petraeus would much prefer that this particular offensive be delayed, both until it could be better prepared and also until their testimony was over. Maliki acted with what appears to be rather impulsively, and the Iraqi armed forces didn't organize themselves with the degree of professionalism that a more highly trained military like the United States might expect. On the other hand, the fact that he was willing to take action against illegal militias, and he, of course, comes from the only party that doesn't have its own militia, so he has some incentive, is not necessarily a bad sign.
John McCain, Senator McCain has begun questioning. Let's listen.
It was not something I recommended, no, sir.
News reports indicate that over 1,000 Iraqi army and police deserted or underperformed during that operation. This was 4 months after Basra achieved provincial Iraqi control, meaning that all provincial security had been transferred to Iraqi security forces. What's the lesson that we're to draw from that, with 1,000 Iraqi army and police deserted or underperformed?
Well, one lesson, Senator, is that relatively new forces, what happened was in one case a brigade that literally had just come out of unit set fielding was pressed into operation. The other lesson is a recurring one, and that is the difficulty of local police operating in areas where there is serious intimidation of themselves and of their families.
Suffice to say, it was a disappointment.
It was, although it is not over yet, Senator. In fact, subsequent to the early days, they then took control of the security at the different ports. They continued to carry out targeted raids. The operation is still very much ongoing, and it is by no means over.
The Green Zone has been attacked in ways that it has not been for a long time, and most of that is coming from elements outside that leave Sadr City or from Sadr City itself. Is that correct?
That's correct, Senator.
And what are we going to do about that?
Well, we have already taken control of the area that was the principal launching point for a number of the 107-millimeter rockets into Baghdad and have secured that area. Beyond that, again, Iraqi security forces are going to have to come to grips both politically as well
as barrage of rocket and mortar fire into the green zone in the center of Baghdad that has killed U.S. Personnel and more than a dozen Iraqis in the last month under discussion here.
Well, as with the ceasefire that was proclaimed in the wake of the militia violence in Karbala in August of last year, it is both to avoid further damage to the image of the Sadr movement, which, of course, is supposed to care for the downtrodden and has a heavy, obviously, it is a religiously inspired movement, but which has been hijacked in some cases by militias, and in fact, other elements have used it to cloak their activities as well. If I could, Senator, also point out that along with the operations in Basra, there were operations in a number of other provinces in southern Iraq, all precipitated by this outbreak in militia violence. In Karbala, Najaf, Qadisiyya, Hilla, Wasit, Dikar, and Mithana, the Iraqi security forces actually did well, in some cases did very well, and maintained security. The same is true in Baghdad, although, again, even there, the performance was uneven in some cases.
There are numerous threats to security in Iraq and the future of Iraq. Do you still view al-Qaeda in Iraq as a major threat?
It is still a major threat, though it is certainly not as major a threat as it was, say, 15 months ago.
Certainly not an obscure sect of the Shiites all overall, Sunnis or anybody else. And al-Qaeda continues to try to assert themselves in Mosul. Is that correct?
It is, Senator. As you saw on the chart, the area of operation of al-Qaeda has been greatly reduced in terms of controlling areas that it controlled as little as a year and a half ago. But clearly, Mosul and Nainawa province are areas that al-Qaeda is very much trying to hold on to. All roads lead through the traditional capital of the north.
They continue to be a significant threat.
They do. Yes, sir.
Ambassador Crocker, in your statement, you talked about a long-term relationship with Iraq, such as a security arrangement, diplomatic, et cetera, economic, that we have with some 80 countries. You envision this after we succeed in this conflict. Is that correct? Or would you talk a little bit about that, elaborate a little more?
Yes, sir. I would actually envision it as helping us to succeed in the conflict. Effort will have two elements. One will be a status of forces agreement. That will be, as I said, approximately like what we have with 80 other countries. It will have some unique aspects to give our forces the authorities to continue.
Ambassador Crocker here describing again the agreement that the U.S. Government Washington hopes to work out with Baghdad for U.S. troops to stay in the country beyond the end of 2008 when the U.N. mandate expires. Ambassador Dobbins, John McCain questioning David Petraeus there and very intent on having the general comment on the continuing threat represented by al-Qaeda in Iraq. How do you interpret that line of questioning from the senator? In
addition to security. Well, I think he wanted to establish that al-Qaeda is still present, still a threat, and still a rationale for us to stay and continue operations in Iraq. And I think Petraeus confirmed that that's the case, that al-Qaeda's presence and activities are much diminished, but they still represent a threat and a potential.
And General Odom, General Petraeus responding that, yes, still a threat, a major threat, but not the threat it was 15 months ago. Does that mean the U.S. has to operate on the assumption that a U.S. pullback could mean the resurgence of al-Qaeda in Iraq?
Quite the contrary. I think al-Qaeda has done well in Iraq precisely because we're there. And the reason you've had an abatement in violence in Anbar, the Sunni province where al-Qaeda was quite strong, is that they're sick of al-Qaeda and they can't operate with the Kurds or the Shiites. But they have been willing to operate with the Sunnis have been willing to operate because they'll help them kill Americans. If we left, al-Qaeda will be kicked right out. We are the major factor keeping al-Qaeda alive there. It is true, however, that some of the Sunnis turning against them, and also the success of our special operations forces have pruned back al-Qaeda rather considerably. There was another point I wanted to make about, I think, McCain's points about Basra and the failed attack down there by the government, or so-called government. Petraeus really gives us quite another picture of the political stability he described earlier. There's lots of violence going on in many towns. So this is a much worse picture than you get from his original point. The other point I would make is that the assumptions that both Crocker and Petraeus bring to this discussion is that there's really a government of Iraq. There's a government of a faction which is using government institutions to spread its influence or to fight its opponents. So we really don't have a true Iraq government.
General Odom, let's listen in for just another moment here as Senator Ted Kennedy, Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts, begins questioning.
Somewhat and significantly different from these 84 other countries, and I think the record's very clear. You're in agreement with what Secretary Dates has told this committee. Just quickly, if you would, please.
I am, sir. It is our intention to negotiate the status of forces agreement as an executive agreement. We do
more
not
questioning here from Senator Edward Kennedy about an onward agreement that may
would, trigger the advise and consent
give a legal basis for U.S. troop presence in Iraq past the end of this year.
Be another issue that we're going to have to come back on. So you're not going to follow what that has been done previously by President Eisenhower, even under President Reagan. Congress approved agreements to the United States for the observer group in the Sinai Desert. You're not going to follow their precedent.
We're going to keep the Congress fully informed. I understand there are some briefings scheduled for the coming few days.
Let me, in the listening to the testimony.
And so the question, questioning well begun of General David Petraeus and Ambassador Ryan Crocker on Capitol Hill. They were there in September. Their testimony then made a big difference in the direction of the American conversation about the Iraq war. They're back this week for 2 days in Washington. They will be before Senate committees, House committees, and we will follow and analyze just as much as we can. I want to thank Ambassador James Dobbins for being with us this hour, Director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at the RAND Corporation. Ambassador Dobbins, thank you for joining us.
Pleasure.
And General William Odom, retired Army Lieutenant General, Director of the National Security Agency, former author of America's Inadvertent Empire. General Odom, thank you for your time today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.